WFAE streaming is sponsored by Corporate Information Technologies, a local IT company assisting business and taking a proactive approach to technology. CIT, let us show you how good IT can be. corp-infotech.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Uptown Charlotte was alive with protesters yesterday afternoon. It just wasn't filled with them. Organizers of the March on Wall Street South projected thousands throughout the country would show up to protest. Charlotte Mecklenburg Police Chief Rodney Monroe says it was more like 800, but the protesters had a lot to say. They called for a moratorium on foreclosures, an end to war, an end to deportations. There were many causes. More than 80 groups signed up to protest. Mark Lee of Durham held a sign that said Democrats and Republicans are both pro-war and pro-Wall Street. He supports President Obama.
But I also want to be sure that he understands that there are a lot of people and a lot of issues out here. Obama himself was a community activist. So I think what you'll find is a lot of community activists are saying that live up to your own ideals. You were a community activist as well.
Many protesters were upset with both the Democratic and Republican parties. Eric Verlo came from Colorado Springs, Colorado, to urge people to vote for, well, no one. His banner said, boycott the vote. Here's
why. That's right. We don't have any choices. These are two corporate parties. There are no real choices. So the only really way to make a statement is to not vote. I mean, voting for lesser evils just shows that you're buying into the system.
Police presence was heavy. Officers linked both sides of the march as protesters made their way through uptown. The march included a stop at Bank of America headquarters, and protesters demanded a moratorium on foreclosures and decried government bailouts to banks.
At this point, we are literally foreclosing on our neighbors with our tax dollars.
The protest was peaceful. There were only two arrests. The protest also attracted the curious, including Republican Sam Wise. He walked a few blocks from his home in the Fraser Park neighborhood. Wise plans to vote for Mitt Romney, but he enjoyed and respected the protest.
I mean, whenever I see the groups, I understand what they're trying to say, and they're probably going about it the right way. I mean, I can remember the 60s seeing people do this, only it was a different thing on the war. So I can relate to them all. I'm glad that they can do it, that Charlotte lets them do it.
Again, the protest was peaceful. There were only two arrests. We'll have more on that later in the program. We'll also talk to WFAE's Julie Rose, who was there for the march. We also talked to reporter Tanner Latham from Carolina Fest, the Uptown Street Festival, a kind of getting-to-know-you party taking place today. And we'll have a report on Saturday night's media welcome party for the DNC and the ethics of participating in it. It should be an interesting, exciting week for locals and visitors alike, but perhaps those most revved up about what's happening here this week are our first three guests. They worked hard to bring the Democratic National Convention to Charlotte and join us now to share some thoughts on how it happened and what they believe will be the result. Dr. Dan Murray is Executive Director of the Charlotte 2012 Host Committee. I thought you'd be tired looking this morning, but you're not. How is that possible?
Oh, this is an exciting time. We shouldn't waste any time sleeping.
Okay. Bob Morgan is president of the Charlotte Chamber of Commerce. Welcome back.
Good morning.
And Michael Smith is president of Charlotte Center City Partners. Good to see you as well.
Thanks. Good morning, Mike.
All of you have these big, bright eyes and smiles on your faces. What's that all about?
It's the most exciting thing to happen to Charlotte in a very long time. We're really happy to be able to host the world this week, and we really feel like we're already a third of the way into the convention. We had our media party Saturday night, our delegate party last night, and today we've got the big open family-friendly event that we're welcoming the whole community for the first time in history.
Now, I know the three of you played a role in helping to bring the DNC or setting the stage to bring the DNC to Charlotte. Would you have been equally happy, and did you try to get the RNC here?
Mike, there was an effort in 1998. There were what I call three young Turks, Charles Jonas, Warren Cooksey, and Frank Whitney, who went after both conventions, got us on a short list of the GOP. We were one of eight cities considered. We had a site visit. We didn't make the final cut. Philadelphia hosted that convention. But I like to recognize those three for planting the seed, the ambition that we could host one of these conventions. One of the things we learned is that there was a lot of work to be done. We have since built a new arena in the center city, which helped our cause. We've built things like the Levine Cultural Campus, the NASCAR Hall of Fame, all of which are part of the picture. Those three and others who were part of that effort planted a seed that reverberates today on the streets of Charlotte, unlike we have ever seen.
What finally clinched the deal? Why did it come here, not St. Louis, not the other cities that were pitching? Why us?
I think a lot of it was the fact that we could offer this convention village. And it's those assets that Bob just called out.
What do you mean, convention village?
Well, this walkable 2 square miles, this incredible experience of that new American city. I think that appealed to those that were trying to organize a convention, to offer that kind of an environment. And they're getting to feel it firsthand right now.
And Dan, you said a minute ago that you already feel like you're 2/3 of the way through the convention. And I know that you went to Tampa last week for a quick trip to see how things were going there and felt at that time that we were, in fact, ready. That was a week ago. And usually things come together at the last moment as if by magic. So why did you think we were ready back then?
Well, you know, Tampa did a great job of their convention. They had a very well-organized event. But what I saw down there was very similar to the preparation I saw us doing. There was nothing they were doing that we weren't doing. But I was also proud to see that there were some things we were doing that they hadn't done, which really included things like Carolina Fest today, where we're opening it up to the public and making it a more lively event. I think people who were uptown last night, they really got a good sense of the energy that is in the city right now.
How did Tampa feel? Because walking down, I drove through the city on Saturday, and I drove through the city yesterday, and I came in this morning. And it is not the Charlotte we have come to know and love. It looks very different. Access obviously has been controlled for security purposes. So how does it compare to what you saw in Tampa?
Well, in terms of the security plan, I would say it's fairly similar in the sense that there is a change in your ability to move around the uptown, and you do have to take more time, and it does create some inconveniences. But having said that, there's a lot more access for pedestrians inside the area where the convention is taking place and in the uptown. And so people can get here and there is a lot more activity. Whereas in Tampa, there really wasn't a way for the public to engage or interact with the convention itself. And I think that's one of the things that we're going to offer that really makes it fun.
Now, were there any particular challenges or things that you didn't anticipate that arose in the course of getting ready for this from the time that the convention people said, yep, you've got it, to today?
Well, I think some of those challenges are well documented. You know, anytime you put on a big event like this, there are a lot of moving pieces, and sometimes you have to go down a path and then change paths. We made the decision to go out to the Speedway at one point, had to change that decision to come downtown, and frankly, we're very excited about that. Speedway's a great venue, but Uptown Charlotte is as well, and Tryon Street's going to be a fun place to show off. We know we can do it here because we've done it with Speed Street and other street festivals before. So I think, you know, there are a lot of things that that you can't predict, that you just have to be flexible and adaptable when you have this many agencies involved and this many moving parts and this many people.
There was a great deal of talk on the part of the convention planners that this was going to be really good for business. Is it?
Mike, we have representatives, 350 representatives of foreign governments in Charlotte this week.
And you handed me a card a second ago before we started, and they're all the Malaysia, Philippines, Kazakhstan, Georgia, Zimbabwe, Guatemala, Colombia, Finland. I could go on and on and on.
Countries you've heard of and countries you have not. And
they're all here.
And we have a captive audience. We're running 3 tours today of 150 of those representatives. 3 of them, a third of them, will study some of our energy sector assets, a third healthcare, and a third education. A captive audience, an opportunity to tell the Charlotte story. They'll all come together for a reception at the end of the day. Just one small example of the kind of audience. You know, typically in economic development, we're going out to sell the Charlotte story, trying to find people willing to listen. This week is so unique because we have the 15,000 members of the media. We have people like these representatives of foreign governments from all over the world. We have some untold number of corporations who are here for the DNC, and we'll have the opportunity to tell that story.
But that's economic development. What about the businesses that are already here? Will it end up being good for them?
It's going to be lumpy. I mean, that's just the truth of it. There's going to be a lot of direct investment from people coming to our city, throwing 1,000, you know, untold parties across our city. But it will be lumpy. It's going to be big wins for some. It's going to displace other customers for others. The big win is not what happens, you know, with this one-time revenue that comes in. It is the opportunity for the Charlotte story to be more fully told.
Mm-hmm. But if you're a small business and you're operating downtown and you couldn't decide whether or not you should open, some have decided not to open because they thought their regulars wouldn't be here and that the conventioners' access to their businesses would be difficult. There was a big article in the paper over the weekend about a woman who owns a jewelry store in the Independence building on the square who decided not to open because she couldn't get in to her business. I mean, did we anticipate this when we got the convention? Because you guys, your job is to support business.
I think we did. And what we've done is we tried to make sure we got great information to all our different constituent groups, whether it was major employers, hospitality venues, small business owners, parking deck operators, and try to answer their questions and connect them with who they needed to talk to, whether it was the Department of Transportation or Secret Service or you name it, CATS.
Now, we have a lot of parking decks that have been closed for the next 4 days because of the streets being sealed off. And I'm just curious, if you're a parking lot owner and you own one of those decks, what about all that revenue they're losing?
Well, actually, a lot of the parking decks were leased by the host committee to put on the event because we needed those for staging. Some of them were needed for media spaces. Some were needed for satellite trucks and other communications things. So we've actually leased a huge number of parking lots uptown. The parking lot owners, by and large, have done just fine.
How many spaces are closed this week?
Boy, I'm not sure I could put a number on it. We have over a dozen parking lots that we've leased.
So several thousand.
Oh yes.
Okay. So the question is.
But we have 45,000 parking spots uptown.
But I'm just curious. As we go through the week and people start coming back to work tomorrow, and I don't know whether you have a handle on how many people are coming back to work tomorrow, or working from home, or working from other locations of the same businesses. But when they come down here. I know Police Chief Rodney Monroe said add 20 or 30 minutes to your commute. Is that optimistic? Is that realistic? Where will these people park?
Well, the vast majority of people are going to either park where they normally park or they will have an alternative parking that's already been arranged. I mean, every uptown business owner, every uptown building owner was contacted either through the Secret Service, the police department, the city, or through Center City Partners about what their options were going to be and how they should manage through this. The additional time is really for going through either some of those security checkpoints for people that are inside the close-in area or for traffic diversion that they will have to go a different route than they're used to going.
So if you're a small...
The right answer, though, is ride transit. I mean, don't drive your own car in.
Right.
I mean, if you need it during the day, there will be access provided. But we're encouraging folks to go to ridetransit.org and figure out – come on conventionally.
Can you ride the rental bikes that were put in a couple of weeks ago?
Absolutely. Come in, ride transit, and then tap that right into B-Cycle.
Okay. If you're a small business and you've decided not to open, do you think that's a mistake or should they reconsider and go ahead and open for this convention? If they can get their people in.
You know, I don't know that I have an answer to that question. I just know that for all of the inconvenience of the traffic situation, the parking situation, a couple of us walking up here this morning, James Taylor was doing a sound check at Trade and Tryon. Yesterday, I was able to bring my family up. Not only did they see the protest and whatever educational value there was in them to see that, they met people on the streets from all over the United States. It will be different. It will be inconvenient in many ways. It will be the most unique opportunity to see and learn on the streets of Charlotte that anybody has ever had. And I just think that those who aren't here are going to miss something pretty special this week.
We know that the Charlotte Regional Visitors Authority is changing their accounting practices to more accurately predict and account for actual dollars spent and actual hotel rooms booked for events that we're attracting. Initially, I think the CRVA estimated that the DNC would generate 75,000 hotel room nights and $75.4 million in direct spending. Denver officials reported $134 million in new spending in 2008. What do you think the economic impact of this convention will be for Charlotte?
Well, I'm not an economist, so I'm not sure I can speak directly to that. I don't have any reason to believe that our impact would be any different than Denver's was.
We predicted 75.4 million, and theirs was 134. Why would it be so much lower than Denver, for crying out loud?
I have no idea. I haven't checked the methodology. All I'm saying is that the hotel rooms are full, and there are over 1,000 functions booked for convention week outside of the official convention activity. So we know there's going to be a lot of impact. But as Michael says, it's going to be spotty. There are some businesses that are in a place where they may not have as much business as they're used to because people don't necessarily come uptown to work.
Well, when you give out these numbers, like the $75.4 million in direct spending, is that number already offset by money that may not be spent by those who come here normally who are staying away?
Well, just to be clear, I didn't put that number out. Mike, you did. I don't know who did that study.
CRVA did, I think.
Okay. But Labor Day is a week where there aren't typically a lot of conventions. And so all of that convention business for that week is really new business because it's not a big tourist season for Charlotte. How much it's offset by people who normally work uptown not coming uptown is really going to be hard to say, but that's something that the economists will have to figure out after the fact.
You know, we've hosted a lot of conventions and tournaments and games and things like that, some rivaling this one for size. And, of course, the Speedway, when they have their Speed Weeks, 130-some thousand people show up for those races. So we have done big events like this, but we haven't done them under the scrutiny of 15,000 media people coming from around the world, nor have we done them necessarily with the kind of security that we have in place here because of the president coming. Does that add a whole new – does that change the equation in a major way?
It changes it exponentially. I mean, I think that is really what creates the complexity of the situation. And not only is it more complex, but there's a much greater spotlight on us when we do it. So it increases the stakes a bit. Mm-hmm. But the good news is that we as a host committee have been working on it for a year and a half. The city and the Secret Service have been working on it for even longer. And they've got a great plan in place, and so far it's working great. I think the demonstration yesterday really showed that.
Michael?
I think it goes back to your prior question, too, about the economic impact. And I don't think that math equation is the right answer. I think it goes back to the fact that it is a smaller convention than others we've hosted. We organized a group for a national PR campaign, and we began that by studying what are the gaps in the way Charlotte is understood. So what are the things that make us great and that the world doesn't know about? So we understand what those are. I mean, they don't have a full appreciation of the value of our airport, the strength of us as an energy center. Having 15,000 media come here give us a chance to tell that story.
The other thing I would say is if you look at the types of businesses that have been able to get involved that had never done anything like this before, it really lays the groundwork for them to do this kind of event in the future. We had over 4,000 businesses sign up on our vendor directory, and we got all our major contracts through that vendor directory. So there are plenty of companies locally here, even a lot of small businesses, and certainly a lot of diverse businesses that would never have had an opportunity to do this and now can say, I've done a convention before, and so they can bid on it anywhere else in the country.
You know, there have been a lot of naysayers over the course of many years here about a lot of the projects that we have done, building of the convention center, building of the Time Warner Cable Arena, building of the Lynx Blue Line. If they'd had their way, would this convention be here?
No.
Mike, great coverage this morning of events at Discovery Place yesterday. You know, for all of the attention on the Levine Cultural Campus, we tend to maybe overlook Discovery Place that's been around for 25, 30 years. One of the New York delegates walked out of an event yesterday and said, why don't we have something like this in New York City? Wow. Wow. It matters. It matters when the public-private partnerships come together to build the kind of assets that now complement an effort like this convention.
Well, that's the other thing that we haven't talked about, and I only have a few seconds left here, but it's not just the economic impact, the short-term impact. It's a long-term impact, and I know that although the AP has already said they're still leaving the NC after Charlotte when they mention the city from now on, it's still going to say Charlotte, NC, as opposed to just being Charlotte, as opposed to just being Tampa, which never has Florida after it. What do you anticipate will happen as a result of this kind of exposure that you cannot afford to buy?
So many people have come to Charlotte to prepare for this convention and said, oh, I've been to Charlotte before, but I never got out of the airport. When they finally came into the city, they were blown away. And they said, we're definitely coming back. We can't believe what a sophisticated, welcoming, and modern and clean city this is. And so I think we've turned over a new page with the world getting to know Charlotte.
I would add, I think we'd like to see new jobs out of this. We're going to see people moving here as a result of this convention. There are hundreds of college students from across America. We've been given the opportunity to invite them. When you finish your education, come to Charlotte to start your career, start your business, start your family. We were the fastest growing metropolitan region in the United States in the previous decade. This convention is going to put us on track to attract the kind of people that we want to help us build Charlotte's future.
I think it was Politico, an article in the Politico section in the Observer yesterday that mentioned somebody as characterizing our airport as being dark, dank, and dingy or something. And I thought, I've been to other airports. I like our airport, and I've been to Fort Lauderdale.
The airport I go through.
Fort Lauderdale's bright and sunny, and you would think it would be. Have you ever been to the airport in Detroit? Holy cow. It's like going to a tomb.
Mike, we all know that reporter was having a bad day. There are a lot of ways to describe the Charlotte airport, but dark and dank is not accurate.
Well, Bob Morgan is president of the Charlotte Chamber, Michael Smith, president of the Charlotte Center City Partners, and Dr. Dan Murray, executive director of the Charlotte 2012 Convention Host Committee. Thank you all for being here. Have good luck this week with this convention.
Thank you, Mike.
You're very welcome. Well, after watching some of the speeches at the Republican National Convention in Tampa last week, more than a few pundits suggested that the GOP was giving fact-checkers a workout. Well, the Democratic Convention hasn't even begun, and at least one fact-checker wants to correct the record, challenging the often promoted and well-held belief that the DNC will be the largest event the city has ever hosted. Not so, says the Charlotte Observer columnist Mark Washburn, and he joins us to set the record straight. Good morning.
Morning.
You're a curmudgeon, aren't you? In your columns, you're occasionally known to needle the powers that be for the decisions that they have made or things that they have said. And last week, you pointed out that the DNC is not the biggest event we've ever held in the city. And this time, you didn't mean it in a needling way, just as fact. So, what is the biggest event?
You know, we don't like to talk about our Civil War history here for various reasons, but in 1929, in June 1929, the last great Confederate war reunion was held in Charlotte, and it took over the town for a week. And it's much bigger than anything we're doing this week. They had to appeal day after day in the newspapers for people to open their homes to the returning Confederate veterans who, you know, the drummer boys were now 83. Some of the oldest one was 107, and people just poured into town. There were a few Confederate reunions after this, but they were dropping off really fast.
Well, this was 1929. They're predicting 35,000 people for this convention. How many people came to the 1929 Convention of Confederate Veterans?
Well, for example, they had a parade on the final day of the convention, and the estimates were from 125,000 to 250,000 people turned out. And, you know, Charlotte's a booster town, so I went with a conservative number. But looking at the papers and looking at the pictures, I'm not sure that it wasn't 200,000 or so. It was absolutely huge. Well, 60,000 people, 60 to 70,000 people came in for the week.
And this was a small place then. The population was very small, and I'm sure that the uptown area that we sit in now was the city. That
was the entire city. Yeah, Myers Park was there.
Yeah, Myers Park was barely there.
Barely there.
So where did they stay? How many hotels did we have?
Well, I could only find the names of two hotels. They're both gone now, but we put up cots at Queens College. They took over the dormitories there. The schools were filled with cots, and all the houses took in the veterans and their wives.
And we doubled our police force.
And you know what's interesting? I got a call from a woman. I got some interesting calls. I got a call from a woman who says, I was 7 years old. I remember that. I stood at the curb. She's 90 now, of course. And another woman called and said, my mother always told me I was born on Old Soldiers' Day. I've never known what that meant until I read your column. She says, I was born on June 9th, 1929. Huh. And all those years my mother said that, I've never known what it meant.
We doubled our police force back then. We had how many officers?
I think we had 45.
So we doubled it to 90 police officers to handle 75,000-some conventioneers. That seems puny in comparison to what we have to handle this crowd now of 35,000.
Oh, cars weren't as big a problem then. And every car in town was dragged into service for the parade.
Of course, there were no protests, I would think, at the convention of the Confederate veterans. What did happen at that convention? Do you know?
Oh, speeches and, you know, some fascinating stuff. There were many old generals left, you know, and they were revered. interesting thing to me was there was a pretty good delegation of former slaves who had taken up arms in the final days of the Confederacy. They came and were honored. And in two cases, there were soldiers who came, officers who had taken their slave with them, you know, into battle, and they were reunited. And in fact, one of them still worked for the guy all those years later as his personal servant. They were quite fond of each other and had their pictures taken and were honored. It was just the strangest thing. It wasn't at all what you would have figured.
Now, I know you were at the media party, which we're going to talk about in a few minutes here, but there's about 15,000 people from the media from around the world here. And of course, all the major television networks are here with all of their big people. What was the media coverage for the Confederate Veterans Convention like?
Oh, the papers were just full of it, completely wall-to-wall. And WPTBT Radio, and I think you were just an intern there then, was going all night with Confederate convention coverage.
They have a recording of the Rebel Yell, which they play on their anniversaries at WBT. I think it came from that convention.
But yeah, they were very big. But the headlines in the papers, Charlotte surrenders to Confederate force and so forth. It was just a big time.
So, was there any lasting effect? Because we're looking for the lasting effect of this convention on our town today. What was the lasting effect that you can find of that convention then?
Well, Grady Cole Center is built on the ruins of, or by the ruins of, what was put up in, I don't know, 74 days, I think they claimed, but they had to build Memorial Hall for the big stuff. So, you know, over there on the edge of Uptown are the ruins and now the Phoenix-like recovery of that Memorial Hall.
Mark Washburn, columnist for the Charlotte Observer. You can read all about that on charlotteobserver.com. I'm not sure that column still exists there. Thank you for being with us. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
We'll get right back to Charlotte Talks here on Charlotte's NPR News Source 90.7 WFAE. Our support comes from WFAE members and the Learning Society of Queen's University of Charlotte, presenting its fall lecture series with business leader Carly Fiorina, Thursday, September 27th. Tickets at queens.edu. Coming up next this hour on Charlotte Talks, we'll hear about the media party that the DNC threw for media coming to the convention over the weekend. We'll also hear live from Carolina Fest, which starts later today in Charlotte. And we'll hear about the protesters who are visiting town this week. That's coming up in this segment on Charlotte Talks. Stay with us.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. DNC Convention Week activities really kicked off yesterday afternoon with the protest march through town. Charlotte was prepared for about 15,000 people to show up for that, but the group was considerably smaller. WFAE's Julie Rose was there, and she joins us now.
Hi, Mike.
Hi. So what was it like? I was watching some television coverage of it, and it looked like there were more police officers than there were protesters.
Well, there weren't more, but there were a lot of police officers. Chief Rodney Monroe was right there at the front. I mean, basically, the place was organized so that they estimate about 800 protesters. And in fairness, I don't think they ever said they were going to get 15,000. Pie in the sky, they hoped for 10,000 maybe. I think realistically, people thought they'd be lucky if they got two. And the police ultimately figured it would be close to 1,000, and that's about what they got. So anyway, it was a lot of people still in the street. And this was a permitted, they knew all of this in advance. And apparently, the protesters had done a lot of coordination with police. So what you basically had was a very long, about 3 mile, I think it must have been. It took 3.5 hours, this march through town. And it was escorted by the police. There were a couple hundred officers, Roddy Monroe says, Chief Monroe. He was right there at the front with his two top commanders walking along at the front of the crowd. They had bike officers kind of moving the group forward at the front, sort of blocking traffic. And then they had bike officers down both sides. And then they had a column of police officers on foot on both sides, keeping all the protesters in the street. It was very well organized. And ultimately, the whole goal was, you know, safety, security was what Chief Monroe said. And they only had two arrests, so I think they figure that was a big success.
Yeah, and as I read about it and as I saw it on television yesterday, what got lost for me was what these people wanted, what they were protesting.
Well, it's a little tricky because this protest was planned for about a year and a half by a group called the Coalition to March on Wall Street South. And by virtue of being a coalition, they had 80, 90 different groups that were involved with a variety of concerns and interests. So you really had I mean, I think the one overarching, and we'll play in a minute some of the voices of some of these folks, they had a variety of concerns, but kind of the one overarching thing that I think everybody I spoke to, no matter if they were coming from the immigration reform side or the union side or the Occupy side or the peace anti-war side, they all kind of seem to come back to and agree on the fact that they feel like they're just not being represented by the two-party system, and that they're frustrated that normal people, reasonable people who don't have money can't get elected. They're upset about the influence of money and corporations in political power. So that was the big thing. But we do have some of their voices just as a chance, kind of a way to give people a sense of what people cared about there yesterday.
Yes, I'm Josie Lenwell, and I'm with Code Pink Women and Men for Peace. And basically, both parties need to address the issue of ending war. Certainly, both parties need to address the issue of money out of politics. And here, we're particularly for bust up the banks also.
Rohima, Mia, I think it's important that we let both parties know that we don't have the money to spend on super PACs and lobbying, and the only way that people get to express what they want is to do something like this.
My name is Richard Koritz. I'm from Greensboro, North Carolina. Most of the main labor leaders in my union, the Letter Carriers Union in North Carolina, signed this strong statement condemning the work of both parties in their relationship to serving working people and the 99%.
Elaine Brower. My son did 3 combat tours as a Marine, 1 in Afghanistan and 2 in Iraq. He came back 100% disabled, and they keep sending them over there into Afghanistan. Why are we wasting our money, killing innocent civilians, losing our soldiers, causing mayhem all over the world? For what? What's the end game here?
My name is Fernando Lopez. As part of the migrant community, we're just tired. We had had enough of oppression, of criminalization for things that we don't even do, and being criminalized just for the color of our skin because we're coming from a different place.
Kate Melges. I'm in town from Cincinnati. I'm the Greenpeace organizer in Ohio. Duke Energy is the largest utility in the entire nation, and they're continuing to invest in coal and nuclear-fired power plants, as well as natural gas, and they're not putting their money where their mouth is and being a forward-thinking company and investing in renewable, clean sources of electricity that will actually save them money and protect the health of their ratepayers.
Martha Kennedy from Winston-Salem. You know, the corporate greed is just killing us, and we want to try to make the corporate people back off from owning our government, because right now they do. They own the legislators, and that's what makes me the maddest.
Some of the voices in yesterday's protest march through downtown or uptown Charlotte, depending upon your point of view, I suppose. Well, something new today, something completely different today. Carolina Fest 2012 kicks off on Tryon Street in just a few minutes. It's a party for the conventioneers and those of us who live here. And WFAE's Tanner Latham is out at Legacy Village by the Gantt Museum right now to set the scene. I know this doesn't start until a few more minutes from right now, Tanner, but what's it look like right now where you are?
Well, there's a lot of setting up, obviously, Mike. I walked down Tryon to get down to where Legacy Village is, and everybody's getting their booths ready. There apparently there's going to be some kind of some dance-off happening. I saw some folks doing choreography. But Legacy Village itself is an area that's set up with a lot of different booths, all geared toward environmental building. This area itself, when you come down, you're actually going to see a house being built right there by the Gantt Museum.
This is Ty Pennington, right?
Well, it's actually one of two houses being built. Ty is building one house, and as I understand it, half of that house was actually built in Tampa at the RNC. They shipped it up here to Charlotte. The other half is going to be built, and then they are. I haven't found out yet where that house is going. The Ty Pennington house. The second house is being built is actually being done by Habitat for Humanity, and I did talk to someone here with Habitat. They told me that they are taking once the house is finished, they are going to then pick it up and move it out to West Boulevard. And so what they're trying to do is they're showing environmental building practices. The Habitat House, at least, is going to be all LEED certified. So that's what we're looking at. This is also, Legacy Village is also the area where the smaller stage is going to be. There's going to be a big stage, the main stage at Trade and Tryon, and then there's going to be the smaller stage down right next to the Gantt.
Now, we already heard Bob Morgan say he eavesdropped on the sound check by James Taylor earlier this morning at that main stage at Trade and Tryon. He performs again at like 5 o'clock this afternoon, and Jeff Bridges is coming in here to perform with his group, and there'll be other entertainers as well. But it all kicks off in about 19 minutes with a Labor Day parade down what, Stonewall Street?
Down Stonewall Street. Now, it's going to begin at Pearl Street Park and head down Stonewall all the way to Marshall Park. And this is going to be a parade full of unions and politicians. I looked at the list, and that's the majority of people. I think there is going to be one high school band that's going to be performing in the parade, but it's mostly going to be geared towards Labor Day specific theme.
Because it's a Labor Day parade. That's anticipated.
I know, right? It makes a lot of sense.
Yes, huh? It does. So that's anticipated to last how long?
They say it's going to last maybe an hour and a half. I mean, from what I've read is that they are going to, what they wanted to do is culminate at the, it's going to finish obviously in Marshall Park, but they want it to finish just in time for Carolina Fest to begin, which is going to be at noon today, right down on Tryon. And so that's the timing. I'm not sure if there are enough floats or enough units in the parade to actually last for 2 hours, but that's the planning.
So very quickly, Tanner, where can people? How do you get here? Should they come? Can you park? Should you take transit? What can you bring? Because there's a threat of rain. Can you bring an umbrella? That kind of stuff.
Well, first off, I would definitely recommend mass transit if you can do that. Try CATS or Lynx. The CATS will be running, the CATS buses will be running on a Sunday schedule. To go to the CATS website and check out what that schedule is going to be. Lynx is actually going to be coming all the way into the Stonewall Station, which is right near the Westin Hotel. But parking is going to be, it's going to be pretty difficult around town. Tryon is blocked off, obviously, up to 6th Street. But on either side for a couple of blocks, the streets are also blocked. And so, you know, the organizers of the festival even recommended parking as far out as south of I-277. So make your plans and figure out where you want to go and try to get here early. As far as bringing things, I talked to a couple of police officers on the street right before the call, and we can bring umbrellas. I know that rain is threatening, so umbrellas are going to be fine for the festival as far as these police officers who I spoke to are concerned.
Okay, and there, of course, will be food and beverages to be sold and bought, et cetera, there, so you don't necessarily have to bring anything else. Tanner Latham, down by Legacy Village near the Gantt Museum, thanks for joining us this morning. The Democratic National Convention means lots of speeches. It also means a lot of partying as lawmakers and delegates celebrate the nomination of their candidate. And reporters are going to have a busy week covering all of this. But this weekend, the media got an elaborate party of its own put on by Charlotte's host committee. In an industry that's squeamish about taking gifts, this is one of the exceptions. And here's how WFAE's Lisa Miller and Michael Tomczyk navigated the ethics of the evening.
I have a confession, Michael. Back when I was an intern, I was at a city council meeting, and they had this table full of bagels and Danishes. And I hadn't had breakfast, and no one was really eating them.
You took a bagel, didn't you?
I did. And as soon as I did, another reporter said to me, "They let you do that where you work?"
Oh, ouch.
Yeah, that was a hard bagel to choke down.
And I bet you never took another one.
No, I didn't.
But you're onto something here. I mean, we in the media often cover events where the hosts lay out food and drinks, and there's always the temptation to take some. But then there's always a question about if that would be ethical.
And now we have this party thrown just for us media folks. The host committee, with help from Time Warner Cable, spent a couple million dollars on food, drinks, and music for the thousands of journalists coming to town. And after that bagel incident, I thought I should get some advice about how to handle it. Charles Bierbauer has reported on several conventions for CNN. He now teaches journalism at University of South Carolina.
I'm sure you'll behave yourself and you'll imbibe in moderation if you do at all. But so much of this is just soaking up the atmosphere so that you can report on it later.
So we're here, Michael, at the media party. And let me tell you, this is a far cry from the breakfast table city council.
Yeah, we've got people dressed up on stilts welcoming the journalists in.
We've got a whole host of southern delicacies, shrimp and grits, fried chicken,
banana pudding,
and not to mention the booze.
It's a completely open bar for 4 hours.
All right. We'll see how we navigate this. And maybe we can get some guidance while we're here as well.
One of the things that surprised me is that people really were partying. The NC Music Factory basically turned into a giant festival with all kinds of really loud music. And people weren't holding back on the dance floor.
Also, the bars were well stocked.
Liquors are Smirnoff, Beefeater, Jim Beam, Bacardi. We got some great tequila.
The host committee really rolled out the red carpet. The committee's chairman, Dan Murray, said there's a reason for that.
Do you think this will impact the stories they tell about Charlotte?
Well, I certainly hope so. You know, we figure if we show them a good time, they might be in a good mood when they write. So hopefully they'll say good things about Charlotte if they have a good time tonight.
But most of the people there weren't actually media. They were politicians, delegates, convention organizers. And a lot of people were just there to party, like Simone Batiste-Céline. She doesn't see a problem with reporters enjoying themselves here. She'll still trust them.
I think at the end of the day, when the hangover clears, I think they're still going to remember exactly what they're here for, and I think they're still going to want to paint an objective picture of what's going on.
In fact, I talked to a reporter who said this party would help her paint a picture of Charlotte. Karen Henriksen is with one of the major daily newspapers in Sweden. It's called, well, I'll let her pronounce it.
Svenska Dagbladet. It means Swedish Daily News.
Henriksen enjoyed some free southern food and beer, and she didn't see anything wrong with that. She says for an out-of-towner like her, the party's a chance to learn more about Charlotte and what people here like to eat and drink.
I've actually even been learning a bit about grits. So I had some grits and shrimp here that were very good.
Shrimp and grits?
Yeah.
Now, she says if she were back home in Sweden and she covered the people paying for everything at the party, she might feel a little different.
Well, I talked to someone in that situation.
I'm Jim Morrill. I'm a political writer for the Charlotte Observer.
And you're drinkless.
I am completely drinkless.
And completely foodless.
And foodless, too.
Now, he doesn't have strong feelings about other reporters enjoying themselves, but this is the policy he operates under.
Typically, when I go to political events or anything like that, I don't partake because I hate to be beholden to any politicians or anybody who's sponsoring the event or the interest group. There was a thought that this represents the same kind of thing.
And remember, he's covered the host committee who put on this party, and he'll continue to cover them after the convention ends.
So there are two approaches. Don't take a thing, or go ahead and eat and drink. Almost all of the journalists we saw at the party were in the second camp. That included Dagmar Hovestedt, who's a producer for German TV News. She says getting to relax with your colleagues from across the globe is an opportunity that doesn't come all that often.
You want to network, you want to meet people, you want to exchange stories, you want to find out what's going on, and it's a casual atmosphere, so it's not really all that official.
So there we are, everybody enjoying themselves. And Michael, about 3 hours in, I was getting pretty hungry.
I think I know the moment you're talking about. Let's play that back.
Let's go get some food.
I'm hungry. It's time.
And the shrimp and grits were great.
And that is where we drew the line. No free booze. But after the party...
I'll get a Catawba Valley brown bear, please.
Do you want to get
a No, I'll just pay for it.
We both bought ourselves beers.
I should have gotten a receipt so I could expense that.
Yeah, that's on WFAE, right?
Yeah.
For WFAE News, I'm Lisa Miller.
And I'm Michael Tomczyk.
Well, to see a video of Lisa and Michael at the party, all you have to do is go to WFAE.org. This is Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members in the American Presidential Experience, a traveling, nonpartisan, interactive exhibit of American presidency, displaying a full-size Oval Office, Air Force One replica, and more. Today through September 8th at West 3rd and South Mint Streets. Details and tickets at presidentialexperience.com. and Jamba Juice Charlotte, now open in Founders Hall Uptown, offering smoothies with up to 4 servings of real whole fruit, vitamins, antioxidants, plus snacks and California flatbreads. Live fruitfully. Details, jambajuice.com. Stay tuned to WFAE and Charlotte Talks throughout the week for coverage of the DNC, the politics, the protests, the big names, and more. It's right here on Charlotte's NPR News Source, 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. Eric Heberling is joining us at this time every day this week to talk about what to expect and to provide analysis of what we've seen as we go through the politics of the convention. Dr. Heberling, of course, is an associate professor of political science at UNC Charlotte. Welcome back.
Morning, Mike.
Are you set? Are you ready? Is this a big event in the lives of political scientists everywhere?
This is like the Super Bowl and the World Series combined.
The number of protesters here yesterday on Charlotte streets was significantly smaller than we anticipated. It was similarly small in Tampa. In fact, a little smaller than it was here yesterday, I guess because of Isaac. What's going on here? Why are so few people here?
It may be just the malaises kick in that people are disappointed and they don't feel like their voice matters one way or the other. And I think this is a discouraging sign for both campaigns in the election that it may be hard to reach the people they think they need to reach.
So if people aren't angry and they're not voting because they're angry, I guess today we're trying to fire them up. These conventions are the purpose of them is to try to fire people up and get them involved.
Yeah, it's a two-pronged process. One, you're trying to fire up the delegates in the hall and the party activists to give them incentive to go out and contact those disillusioned people and get them to the polls by almost any means necessary. But the second is to talk to the less certain voters who are tuning in by television who are trying to decide how they want to vote and give them a reason to choose your side.
Now, today is set aside. It's another big party. We've had at least two big parties in a protest. Tomorrow is opening day. That's when the convention really gets down to business. What should we expect out of day one of a convention like this?
Day one of the convention is the party setting the scene, setting its themes for the convention. They have the keynote speaker on the opening night. The Democrats are using the mayor of San Antonio to highlight an up-and-coming star. They're going to have a lot of mayors, and this is one of the key mayors we'll hear from. I presume they're highlighting mayors as a way of showing that the competence of the Democratic Party. Contrast it with the lack of movement on anything in Washington.
Well, Politico wrote this morning, as Democrats prepare to deliver their party's message this week in Charlotte, convention season has already made one thing abundantly clear. If you want to find the next generation of Democratic leaders, look to City Hall.
Absolutely. And one thing conventions do is allow the parties to highlight their up-and-coming stars. I mean, this is how Obama hit the national stage in 2004 as a state senator, mm-hmm. blew us away with his red versus blue speech, and it's hard to think of him becoming a national figure without that event at the 2004 convention.
We're doing this program obviously from Spirit Square, and there's a big sign out in the lobby here at Spirit Square because the two theaters here are being used by the convention, and they've had meetings and seminars and caucus meetings here already. And today, the Black Caucus, the Hispanic Caucus, the Native American Council, the Caucus of Veterans and Military Families, and the Faith Caucus, this may come as a surprise to Republicans, along with the Disability Caucus and the Youth Council will be meeting. Tomorrow, the Women's Caucus, the LGBT Caucus, the Small Business Caucus, among others, will meet. How does this variety of groups compare to what might have taken place in Tampa?
It'll be different types of groups, or I should say different emphases in the groups. But I think that the key that's different is these are activities that most people don't know about, don't know that they happen at conventions. And the Democrats have made very clear that they want to encourage the public to come to these meetings and participate. So that the host committee has promised us the most open and accessible convention in history, and the media's kind of convinced about that. But I think what they really mean is the most opportunities for ordinary members of the public to participate. So we have Carolina Fest today. We have all these caucus meetings that ordinary people can just show up and hear the policy discussions, hear what the party activists themselves are hearing.
Yeah, this is new. You can just walk in?
You can just walk in.
Because when I covered the convention in San Francisco years ago, you had to have credentials and all that sort of thing. So you can just, if you know where these meetings are taking place and when they are taking place, you as Joe Public can just walk in and listen.
Yeah, they're outside the security zone. If you go to the host committee's website, charlatan2012.com, and click events, they have all these events listed, and I think people would be impressed by the number of things that are listed there. And you can click on a particular event, and it brings up all the information on it, when it is, where it is. Come on down.
So the when these people get together in their various caucuses, and there are state caucuses every day at which people come and speak, then I guess – They're getting fired up. They're getting their marching orders. They're getting the message, the theme of the convention, the theme of the campaign. How does all this interact with what happens at the actual convention?
I think what it does, it's kind of the preliminary revving people up. So many of the speakers who appear at the state delegation breakfasts to speak are the same speakers who will appear on the stage at night. This is an opportunity for delegates to hear them in a more intimate setting. They might do some Q&A, but it's really a chance for these up-and-coming party leaders to become known by the activists and leaders of individual states.
Now, Mayor Fox is among the speakers kicking off the convention. He speaks tomorrow night early in the evening, but nonetheless, he speaks, and he'll be on national television if you watch C-SPAN or PBS or you watch the streaming feeds from the various networks. There'll be a series of speakers. Do we know what the themes are each night? Because the Republicans had a theme each night. Do the Democrats have that this year, or do you know?
They almost always do. I haven't found anywhere where it's listed.
So there'll be a series of speakers, most of whom we won't hear unless you're watching C-SPAN or PBS. Do these speaking assignments have a function at the convention other than serving as a reward for a job well done for people like Mayor Fox?
It is a reward. It's an opportunity to become more well known on a national stage. It's an opportunity for the party to see who does well in that type of venue, who doesn't do well. So it's a setup for future conventions or future tours of the country.